Kansas Governor Jeff Collier has signed a bill that authorizes a $500 million increase in public school funding over the next 5 years. It's a controversial bill. Conservatives say it's way too expensive. Others say it falls short of addressing the Kansas Supreme Court ruling that essentially forced lawmakers to once again boost state aid to schools. The back and forth is simply the latest chapter in a long-running debate, a debate in which there have been many twists and turns and plenty of drama. I'm Jim McLean. On this episode of Statehouse Blend Kansas, we're going to delve into that history, a history that helps us understand what's happening today and what still might happen as this latest funding bill heads back to court. As mentioned, Governor Jeff Collier has signed a bill that would increase public school funding by $500 million over 5 years. Acting as both governor and candidate, Collier traveled to a Topeka area high school to do the honors. Referring to a drafting error in the bill that lessens its funding by about $80 million, the governor says he's confident the lawmakers will fix that mistake in a trailer bill. He's also at least willing to appear confident that when made whole, the bill will increase funding enough to satisfy the Supreme Court.
I think that we will fix the bill, and I think it will satisfy the court. This moves the ball. $500 million is a very significant commitment and a very good start at this.
Maybe too good. At least that's what one of Collier's chief rivals in the 2018 governor's race thinks. Kansas Secretary of State Chris Kobach called his own news conference just minutes after the governor's to criticize Collier for signing a bill that he says the state can't afford.
The $500 million plus spending plan that Governor Collier signed this morning is a disaster. He should not have signed it. He should not have encouraged the legislature to pass such a huge spending hike.
Collier says the state can't afford the boost in school funding when it's spread out over 5 years without increasing taxes. But Kobach says the governor is wrong. He says Collier is making faulty assumptions about the economy, anticipated tax revenue from online sales, and the state's ability to continue to juggle budget obligations.
It is inevitable that the legislature next year will be sending a tax hike to the governor. We need a governor who's going to veto it, not a governor who has aided and abetted such a future tax increase as Governor Collier has.
In response, Collier essentially says that Kobach's criticism is to be expected, given that he is a candidate who doesn't yet have to make tough decisions required of a governor.
We're actually getting things done, and today is an excellent example of actual accomplishment.
This is a theme that we're likely to hear play out over numerous issues as the campaign for the Republican gubernatorial nomination unfolds. Collier thought that finishing out the remainder of former Governor Sam Brownback's term would give him a leg up in the race for the nomination, a chance to show voters that he could govern in a way that the man he served as lieutenant governor for 7 years couldn't. But that governing business could be a double-edged sword. In this case, it gives Kobach a chance to peel conservative voters away from Collier by characterizing the governor as a tax-and-spend Republican. It'll be interesting to see how that plays out over the course of the primary campaign. The relationship between the legislature and the courts is a big part of this story. That contentious relationship is the reason that lawmakers are considering a constitutional amendment to, in the future, prohibit the Kansas Supreme Court from deciding whether they are meeting their constitutional obligation to fund schools. The state's historic failure to meet that test, at least in the eyes of the court, has been an issue since the beginning of this debate. But in 2005, it almost resulted in a constitutional crisis, a crisis that could have shut down Kansas schools. Celia Yopis Jepson of the Kansas News Service takes us back to that critical moment in Kansas history.
In the summer of 2005, 12 days of political drama started with a prayer, a rhyme actually, by the Reverend Fred Holloman. He was chaplain of the Kansas Senate, and he's played here by my colleague Brian Ellison.
Heavenly Father, I'm sure you've noticed that we're back much sooner than expected. The court's not pleased with what we did, so our proposal was rejected. We've received an ultimatum to which some have objected.
It was June 22nd. The legislature was back in Topeka for a special session. That spring, they had added $142 million in funding for schools, but the Kansas Supreme Court told them to double it by July 1st.
In the name of Jesus Christ, amen.
So unless lawmakers complied, the court would likely close the schools. Governor Kathleen Sebelius called lawmakers back for this extra session, and she wanted them to do as the court said.
I absolutely did.
Steve Morris of Hugoton was the Senate president. the Senate got down to business revising school finance.
We thought we were putting an adequate amount of money in, but court saw it and thought otherwise. So I thought, well, we'll just have to do what we have to do.
The Senate president had told a few committees to draft a bill in time for the start of the emergency session. So the Senate passed it on their first day back with little thought of defying the court.
We have equal branches of government, and we need to remember that.
But in the House, Speaker Doug Mays of Topeka and other conservatives like Mike O'Neill from Hutchinson were frustrated. O'Neill remembers back in 2005 looking at a 1994 school finance ruling.
Courts have no power to overturn a law enacted by the legislature within constitutional limitations, even though the law may be unwise, impolitic, or unjust. The remedy in such case lies with the people.
O'Neill was annoyed the courts were interfering on school spending. If the legislature was doing a bad job funding schools, Kansans could vote them out. That was the check and balance.
And so, yeah, we were pretty shocked that this court would not only weigh into that issue, but literally order the legislature to appropriate a certain amount of funds.
O'Neill was in charge of the House Judiciary Committee. Still, Governor Sebelius thought he had it wrong. The court was within its rights.
And I told him this at the time, and I told legislators at the time that I thought he was giving bad legal advice.
So the Senate waited day after day. The chamber's top Democrat, Minority Leader Anthony Hensley, remembers.
At one point, I put out a news release where I called it Mays Malaise.
Referring to the House Speaker's last name.
They were unable to do anything.
It's not like nothing was happening, though. Lawmakers who felt the court was out of bounds were busy figuring out how to rein it in. They talked about asking voters for a constitutional amendment, blocking the court from meddling in spending. Bill Rich, a law professor at Washburn University, urged lawmakers not to do it.
What I testified to in essence was that would mark a really radical change in the history of the relationship between the judicial and legislative branch of government.
Rich says carving out parts of the Constitution as unenforceable by courts was a slippery slope. So, if lawmakers wanted to stop judicial scrutiny, that wasn't a good way to do it. They should be more direct. Just take the duty to fund public schools right out of the Constitution.
But I think the legislature knew that that was not going to pass.
Meanwhile, the July 1st deadline came and went. Kansas was getting close to a constitutional crisis, a showdown between the legislature and the court.
That's really what it felt like. It did feel like we were on the verge of a train wreck.
Attorney Alan Roop represented the school districts that were suing the state for more money. They were arguing kids weren't getting the education they deserved. Then came a late-night meeting in the governor's office on the second floor of the State House with all the key players, including Speaker Mays. Tim Carpenter, the Topeka Capital Journal's State House reporter, stood outside, waiting to ask questions.
A lot of this stuff, when it gets down to the nitty-gritty, occurs behind closed doors.
But the speaker left suddenly and in no mood to answer those questions. He took one look at the reporters and stormed off.
Out burst Doug Mays. His heel was just pounding the pavement with each step, and he was coming right at me. I was standing right in front of him. And just as I opened my mouth, he pivoted hard left, and all I could see was the back of his jacket as he disappeared into the rotunda of the Capitol.
Senator Hensley was in the room.
It was a very intense meeting. I don't recall that the governor actually said we have the votes to bypass you, but I do believe Speaker Mays understood that that was the case.
That's because, despite the speaker, moderate Republicans and Democrats had been talking about a bill to add that $143 million. The next day, July 2nd, was a Saturday. The justices put out an order giving the state 6 days to come up with any last-ditch reasons why they shouldn't cut off money to schools. Attorney Alan Roop.
When the court issued their order to appear and show cause, it was clear that the court meant business.
School administrators were getting more nervous by the minute. Randy Wiesman, the superintendent in Lawrence, wrote a letter to his school board.
School board members and colleagues, as you know, today marks another attempt by the legislature to make something happen. A joint education conference committee began at 10, and who knows what the rest of the day will bring.
He was planning for the worst possible scenario.
To ignore this possibility is, in my opinion, irresponsible.
Cutting off money to schools
Therefore,
was unprecedented. Wiesman didn't know how long he would have authority to keep paying the bills, and with new schools under construction in Lawrence and utility bills coming in.
I mean, when you're talking about not providing education in August for, you know, 11,000 kids, 2,000 employees. It's a huge undertaking to talk about just stopping that train.
In the days that followed, the House and Senate worked it out. O'Neill was one of the six negotiators.
Yeah, we basically had to pay the ransom and make sure the schools were going to open and then try to rest easy at night knowing that we've prevented the court from threatening to do this in the future.
2 days before state lawmakers were due back in court, both chambers signed off on the money. Senate President Morris.
Well, it felt like that we'd taken a load off, done what we needed to do.
Conservatives left negotiations with something too, a policy encouraging schools to spend more of their money on instruction, extra procedures for school finance lawsuits, and most importantly, they barred the courts by law from closing schools.
So we felt like we got quite a bit of reform in exchange for writing a bigger check.
It wasn't a constitutional amendment. All those failed. Still, O'Neill thought it was enough, but the court today seems undeterred.
Few have been in the middle of the Kansas school funding debate longer than Mark Tallman. He's the Associate Executive Director of the Kansas Association of School Boards. I recently sat down with Mark to ask him to walk us through the history of this seemingly never-ending dispute.
The litigation really began in the early 70s, as was happening in many states, around the idea that student educational opportunities should not be dependent on local resources, which is how we typically in America funded public education. That resulted in something called the School District Equalization Act, where the state took a larger role in trying to equalize funding
right.
opportunities.
So let's stop there just for a second. I think that SDEA concept is really important to this whole issue because, as you point out, and people know this intuitively, but there are rich school districts and poorer school districts. It has to do with your property valuation. I remember in those days hearing a lot about the Burlington School District because the Wolf Creek Nuclear Power Plant was under construction, and that was going to increase the tax base of that county exponentially to the point where a mill in taxes would raise X number of dollars compared to the Galena School
Correct.
District, where down in southeast Kansas, where a mill of property taxes raised substantially less than that. And the point of the SDEA was to essentially equalize the amount of aid that went to either of those school districts in base student aid. Is that correct?
That's absolutely correct. We didn't call it base aid at the time. It was more based on the idea that you had local choice in how much you wanted to raise and spend locally, but the state would kind of match that
mm-hmm.
in inverse relationship to your wealth. So the poorer you were, the more you got, the wealthier you were, you might not get anything.
So in the early 70s, we established the SDEA, the School District
Correct.
Equalization Act, early 1970s. What happened after that?
Well, I think the easiest way to say it is noble goals, but it wasn't funded enough to do the job. There was, in the early 90s, a spot in Johnson County where you had three school districts coming together, relatively similar demographics, et cetera. One of those districts had an operating mill levy of about 33 mills, one of those districts had an operating levy of about 66 mills, and one of those had an operating levy of about 99 mills.
And what is a mill? A mill, again, is a taxing unit.
It's a taxing unit. It basically is $1 for every $1,000 of assessed valuation.
Okay.
Is what. But that's the common way we look at it. So the point is not you didn't have to travel all across the state. Right at a corner, fairly similar districts. That's how stark the differences were, even under the SDEA. That's what led to, even before going to the Supreme Court, the legislature responded to a lower court ruling to say this is clearly a problem. So the legislature passed a law called the School District Finance and Quality Performance Act that significantly raised state funding to create a uniform base amount across all districts.
Is that where we got the statewide mill levy?
That's where we got the statewide mill levy, and that's where we got the idea the state would really fund most of a school district's operating budget, leaving some measure of local flexibility called the local option budget. Jim, I also want to point one thing that is also in that title, the Quality Performance Act, because up until that time, school funding and, frankly, state policy pretty much just looked at funding and trying to equalize tax effort. But written into this law for the first time was a mandate on the state board. We're going to have a much more robust state oversight of academic performance. We're going to start having state tests every year in certain subjects and certain grade levels. We're going to have an accreditation system that is supposed to be based on how well kids do. And we're going to require that we look at not only kind of overall student performance, but performance of different student groups. What's interesting is I've always kind of argued, and this was not original with me, that sense of accountability was part of what many legislators kind of insisted on as the price of more funding, and yet it really created the body of evidence that about 10 years later in Montoy is what plaintiffs used to say funding was not adequate.
Okay, so we passed this new law in the 90s. Again, noble goals.
Right.
We not only was it going to deal with the issue of funding, but it was also going to deal with the issue of the quality of the education that was being offered, trying to equalize that as well so that students were performing at roughly equivalent levels across the state. So we had that happen in the 90s, and then you just referenced the Montoy case. Tell us where that came from.
Well, the Montoy case was filed by a group of districts, and it was the first time to really both explicitly look at sort of equity, difference in tax rates, partially because districts were relying more and more on that local option budget, but more fundamentally, it was about differences in student group performances. It was brought about by districts that tended to have larger groups of low-income, minority students who may not do as well, often linked to income, students with disabilities, English language learners. And their basic argument was, we're not getting enough money to solve these kids. You could almost think of it this way. The first round from the 70s and on was basically saying, you should be able to have the same amount per child. The next round was to say, regardless of tax effort, mm-hmm. The next round is to say, but students are different and
right.
Some kids need more than others. And what happened was in Montoy, the legislature fought it all the way Supreme Court, basically saying, no, we're doing fine. You know, we shouldn't be required to do anything else, or you know, our system is okay. And ultimately, the Supreme Court ruled with the plaintiffs, ironically relying on, in part, a cost study that the legislature had commissioned in the early 2000s called the Ogden, Blake, and Meyer study, which had argued that more money would be needed, particularly for some of these student groups. And so I would say, again, the irony is the legislature both created the evidence of disparity by having an accountability system that looked at individual students and student groups and paid for a study which argued funding was not adequate. Based on that evidence, the court ultimately said you are not funded correctly. The legislature then commissioned another study done by its own post-audit division, which came back and said, you know, no, you're not funded enough, and your weightings aren't high enough to deal with these individual students. That resulted in the legislature passing what is sometimes called the three-year plan, which phased in $400 to $500 million over that period of time. Much of it focused on at-risk low-income students, bilingual students, special education dollars that was supposed to sort of reach a full phase-in 2009. Of course, if we again remember our somewhat more recent history, that plan was phasing in exactly at the time that the greatest economic crisis since the Great Depression hit. The legislature never reached the funding levels they were supposed to, and in fact, actively began backing away from that. Funding levels actually declined. Equity funding went down, creating widening disparities. And so the Gannon case was filed. And what the court essentially said is, well, number one, we've already told you you can't allow widening disparities based on wealth, which lack of equalization dollars is doing. That was the Gannon equity piece. And then second, the legislature said you need to base your funding on what it costs to get kids to a certain level of achievement.
Mm-hmm.
And the big thing that then happened in the last few years under Gannon is the court finally articulated what it calls the adequacy standard is funding to help kids meet the Rose standards. And that name comes from a Supreme Court decision in the state of Kentucky that spelled out kind of seven basic goals of an education system. The court then sent the case back down to the trial court saying, all right, we've articulated that these are the standards. We're not going to talk about necessarily old cost studies. We're kind of starting over. Do we have is our system allowing students to reach these standards?
And just so we're fixed on the timeline here, when did that happen?
I believe that was around 2014, okay. 2014, 2015. Again, you know, these things have kind of gone right back and forth because at that time it went back to the trial court, a three-judge panel. That court said, okay, we've looked at these standards and we still think funding is inadequate based on various factors. That went back up to the legislature and it was really last, 2 years ago that the Supreme Court said, we agree with the trial court, legislature, you need to respond. So last session, the legislature passed a bill, Senate Bill 19, did a number of things, but specifically it added about $300 million over a two-year period, the school year we're in now, and money appropriated for next year. In October, last October, the Supreme Court said, that's still not enough, or rather, and I want to be clear about this, it is not that they specifically said it isn't enough. It's that they said the legislature has not demonstrated that it is enough to remedy the problems the court had found.
Fast forward to now, the legislature has reached first adjournment. It has passed a school funding formula that, in addition to the $300 million called for in last year's legislation, adds how much?
It adds about $500 million to what has already been appropriated, about another $100 million for next year on top of what had been provided, and then roughly $100 to $115 million each of the next 4 years. It's important to understand that is kind of direct state funding for operations. There is some additional ability for districts to turn to their local option budget, but most districts are pretty much at the limit they can get to. So that's not necessarily counting everything, but it's probably a big chunk of it. And just for the record, in the sake of transparency, it's also worth noting there are definitely other dollars that the legislature puts into education. These numbers don't count the legislative contributions to the CAPERS retirement system, which is going up, and they don't count legislative matching money for bond and interest programs and capital outlay, which are two ways districts can provide for their capital, their physical building needs. The $500-600 million we're talking about is really for their operating, their general operations.
And this is already confusing enough. We could make it a lot more confusing by taking us back. That was part of the argument in the Brownback years. He would always cite the total amount of money that was going to schools in those other categories.
Correct.
As well, talking about how funding levels were at record levels.
Yes.
And then you'd have to parse the discussion to get to the point of how much of that was getting to the classroom versus these other interests. And that led to the Brownback administration's block grant formula, which tried to put all those funds into one bucket. And the court found that specifically unconstitutional.
It did, although it kind of noted, I think the Supreme Court sort of said, look, we understand this was a two-year thing, we know it's expiring, and they didn't spend a lot of time on that.
So now we sit here, the $2 billion question, the $1.7 billion question, whatever you want to say, the big question hanging out there right now is whether or not this new funding formula that was, you know, pretty contentious there in the end, in the final hours of the first part of the session, is that going to be enough to satisfy the court? Of course, you don't have the answer to that, but I would wager that you've done a great deal of thinking about that, as have your members. You know, what is the conjecture at this point as to whether this will get us there finally?
Well, I think many, many people in the education community are skeptical, and I don't know whether that's based on legal analysis or simply their feeling, you know, we're far behind. On the other hand, what the court may be willing to do is say, all right, you've made a credible effort. We're going to acknowledge that. We are an appeal court. We are not the trial court. We don't look at facts. We look at law and potentially say we will send this back down to the trial court to try to work through what it's done, and we will retain jurisdiction while that happens and while we see, while we begin to see the impact.
Thanks to Mark Tallman and to Celia Yopis-Jepson of the Kansas News Service for walking us back through the history of this critical issue, a history that hopefully gives us a better perspective on what's happening today. Next week on Statehouse Blend Kansas, we'll be looking ahead to what will be the legislature's brief but almost certainly eventful wrap-up session. I hope you'll join us for that. Meantime, I'm Jim McLean. Thanks for listening today. It's been great to have you as a part of our growing audience. For Statehouse Blend Kansas.